I should correct any misapprehensions caused by Roger Freeman in introducing so well-known a figure as myself, whose name escapes you for the moment. I'm not a professor of economics, and at the moment I'm not even a professor of political science. When I went to Claremont, President Benson offered to appoint me as professor of political theory, but I pointed out to him that I had just recently published an article which had already been reprinted and I think was rather widely read, called The Case Against Political Theory. Thereupon, he appointed me professor of political philosophy. Now, all professors of political philosophy, properly so called, are disciples of Socrates, who, I'm afraid, falls into that category so lamented by the junior senator from New York, of not only being inclined towards the hemlock himself, but rather commending it to others. I'll try to avoid, and I'm afraid that the brief experience that I had with Senator Goldwater only confirmed that judgment, at least in the senator. So I only stand here as the representative of political philosophy, which is the tradition that goes back to that old hemlock thinker. Now, I want to, since we're talking about the American political tradition, I thought it appropriate that I would make reference today to a book which is called The Basic Symbols of the American Political Tradition, a book put together by Professor George Carey from the Vanderbilt lectures of the late Wilmore Kendall and finished and elaborated by Professor Carey. It's a book with which I have little agreement. But before I express my disagreements, I wanted to pay what I think is a tribute to Wilmore Kendall. I think that Wilmore was the best teacher of political philosophy of his generation in this country, at least the best native teacher. He came to sit at the feet of several other teachers himself, whom he acknowledged as his masters. Wilmore was, I think, a true disciple of Socrates. He managed to contradict just about everything that anybody said to him, and when he ran out of antagonists, he contradicted himself. If he had a fault, I think that he loved his country not wisely, but too well. And I think he came to believe, certainly by the end of his life, that the picture of the virtuous republic deliberating sagely and wisely under God was the highest view of the American republic that he could take. And he believed that that was the true American political tradition. He found the model for that not in the Federal Convention or the Continental Congress, which drafted the Declaration of Independence, but in the Mayflower Compact. Now, I must say that I probably share some of Wilmore's, I won't call it advice because I don't believe that it's vicious, some of his tendency, I won't call it even a failing. But that is to say, I think that in my writings I have tended to identify the American political tradition with what I thought was the best in the world. There is that tendency for those of us who do love our country to identify it with the things that we come to regard independently as the best. But whether or not the best is our own tradition or not remains a problem. Now, the main thesis, if I may say so, of the Kendall Carey book is, as I have said, that one finds the American political tradition at its root in the Mayflower Compact and not in the Declaration of Independence. But it also involves treating the equality proposition in the Declaration and those other manifestations of it as essentially, if not irrelevant, then at least not central. The commitment to equality, which of whom, the commitment to which Lincoln after Jefferson became the greatest symbol is something that Kendall and Carey reject. Now, in order to understand this problem in its proper perspective, I would like to make reference to a political happening, if you will, of fairly recent vintage. In 1968, a presidential commission, I think called the Kerner Commission, made its report on the causes of civil disorder, which had been plaguing the country since the Watts riots in 1965. The headline that came from that report, and about the only part of the report which I think made any great impact on public consciousness, was the proposition that the United States was a racist country, and that racism was at the root of all of our difficulties. Some weeks after the commission report appeared, I happened to be at a conference on the subject of dissent and civil disobedience, attended by David Ginsburg, who was executive director of the Kerner Commission. And in the course of the conference, he made some remarks to the effect of our being a racist country. And he mentioned, incidentally, that a kind of prima facie evidence of this being the truth was the fact that when the Declaration of Independence was written, it was not understood that the phrase, all men are created equal, applied to or included Negroes. I asked him what gave him that opinion, and he stated as a matter of course, well, he thought that all educated men knew that. I said, well, how do you know it? John Hope Franklin had assured the commission that that was the case. I pointed out to him that this is what Chief Justice Taney had said in the Dred Scott decision, and that we had fought a great civil war to deny that proposition. Now, of course, nobody can say that a war decides what's true or what's false. And it certainly can't decide the question of whether or not Taney was right or wrong. However, there was an immense body of literature, beginning with the independent Democrats in Congress who attacked the Taney report, and the Republican Party of that day. I'm sorry, it was the Republicans. It was the independent Democrats who attacked the Kansas-Nebraska Bill of 1854. The Dred Scott decision was 1857. But Abraham Lincoln, at the head of a great body of opinion, had as well, including some of the dissenting justices, had supplied overwhelming evidence that the Declaration of Independence did mean to include the Negro, and that the statement that men are not only that men are created equal, but that they have certain unalienable rights, certainly included all men as men. And moreover, that there was no question but that the Negro was a man. A very curious point about Justice Taney's opinion in the Dred Scott case is that the only evidence that he cited in his opinion to show that Negroes were not regarded as men were the laws in the various colonies and in the states subsequent to July 4th, 1776, the laws preventing or outlawing miscegenation. That is to say, the only documentary evidence in that opinion against the humanity of the Negro are laws against miscegenation. Now, ever since Aristotle, the primary test of whether or not two beings are members of the same species is whether or not their sexual union is capable of producing offspring. In other words, the laws against miscegenation could only prove that Negroes were regarded as human beings. And so, in fact, was evidence directly contrary to what was maintained. Now, Kendall and Carey, in their book, do not discuss at all the question of the status of the Negro, nor the relationship of the Declaration of Independence and the principles it holds forth to the institution of chattel slavery. But both Kendall and Carey agree, and John Hope Franklin essentially agree that equality or the commitment to equality as understood as a serious political, as having serious political meaning, is no part of the American political tradition. And so I think we find, again, a case of thinkers and writers on the left and on the right agreeing on a proposition which is, I think, contrary to what I would call the middle of the road, but also, in this case, I think, contrary to the truth. Now, the kind of evidence which John Hope Franklin appeals to, and as a matter of fact, the kind that not so much Judge Taney in 1857, but Stephen A. Douglas, who became Lincoln's great antagonist in the joint debates of the following year, said that the signers of the Declaration would have been hypocrites if they had meant to include Negroes in the statement that all men are created equal and had continued themselves to hold slaves. Now, Lincoln's reply to that is that the statement that all men are created equal is a statement of principle. It also states a set of obligations which men are bound to act on if they understand those principles, if they have the power of acting on them. Lincoln pointed out that, of course, they didn't immediately cease to own slaves or take any immediate action to overthrow slavery, for the very simple reason that they had no power to do so. Not only did they not place Negroes on an equality with whites, they didn't place whites on an equality with whites. They stated a principle, the implementation of which they would be obliged to pursue as circumstances permitted. Now, that's, in general, Lincoln's answer. But it seems to me it's not sufficient for understanding the problem presented by the statement that all men are created equal. We hear a great deal these days, and I heard a great deal in this room yesterday, about the evils of egalitarianism. Now, insofar as egalitarianism means trying to treat unequal people as if they were equal, I think it is a bad thing. Insofar as it means treating equal people as if they were equal and unequal people as if they were unequal, it's only a statement of the principle of distributive justice as understood since Aristotle. Lincoln once commented on the fact that a Negro woman might be said to be his inferior. He said, very well, if she's only entitled to, if her labor is only worth a small amount, then pay her a small wage. But, he said, the little that she earns should be hers as much as the larger amount that is mine. The fact that she is capable of earning little doesn't mean that she's not entitled to keep what was hers. So it is a principle of distributive justice. And I believe from this point of view, the Declaration of Independence only incorporates the natural law tradition, which in various ways and under different guises certainly extends at least as far as Aristotle. However, the Declaration of Independence is also the statement of a principle of political obligation. As a principle of political obligation, it has a meaning somewhat different than what one would find in the writings of Aristotle or of any ancient writer. What does it mean? Now, one must remember that the Declaration of Independence justifies the separation of the United States from Great Britain. It states why Americans are no longer obligated to obey British law by stating the principles on which any man at any time is ever obligated to obey any law. Now, what could the ground of obligation be? Let me restate the proposition that all men are created equal in a negative sense, because it is a statement about the relationship not only of men to each other, it's a statement of the relationship of men to each other by relating them simultaneously to God and the universe, to the order of creation altogether. And in that context, it means that there is no difference between one man, and any other man, which would justify the one man being the ruler of the other man, the way in which any man is the ruler, let us say, of any dog. Man and dog, that is to say, man and the species inferior to man in the order of creation, can only meet on the relationship of subordination and superordination. There is a relationship of authority that stems from the nature of the universe itself between man and that part of non-man which is subhuman, just as there is a different relationship between man and the superhuman, between man and his creator. The universe is not an indifferent atomic mass with no distinctions relevant for the government of man. Government does not arise, obligation to obey does not arise from nature. It arises from the only alternative which is conceived of by the Declaration, and I think the only alternative which one can conceive of when one looks at the problem this way. The only alternative is consent. Consent. Authority, the just powers of government are derived from the consent of the governed. A dog does not consent to be governed. He may have to be chased and captured and conditioned to obey, but he doesn't have to consent. There is no possibility of consent. The possibility of consent is a function of man's capacity to reason. And this is called a self-evident truth. Now, I submit that the proposition which is called a self-evident truth is a self-evident truth. That is to say, it is a truth the evidence for which is contained within the proposition which expresses it, and it is understood by anybody who grasps the terms of the proposition. A self-evident truth is not one which is necessarily conceded by everyone, because not everybody understands it. As Thomas Aquinas said, what is self-evident to the wise is not self-evident to all men. How many people understand the Declaration of Independence may certainly be disputed. Perhaps it was a rather optimistic view of the matter that led Jefferson to think that it was widely understood even in his own time. There can, however, be no question but that Jefferson understood it himself, and that the men who signed the Declaration, certainly all of those who left a record of their views, understood it in his sense. And anyone who would controvert this view of mine would have to produce evidence that there was anyone in 1776 or in the decade thereafter who understood that any Negro was obligated to remain a slave if he had it within his power to cease being a slave. Because the statement that all men are created equal means that no man has an obligation under the laws of nature and of nature's God to obey a law to which he does not in any reasonable sense have consent. And the argument that Jefferson was a hypocrite because he didn't emancipate his own slaves would have to, that proposition would rest upon the demonstration, first of all, that he had the power to emancipate his slaves or to emancipate them in a way that would have been beneficial to them, and that he did not do so, and also that he felt that any slave who ran away from him was repudiating obligations which he, the slave, had under the laws of nature and of nature's God. And I submit that such evidence is not and never has been forthcoming. Now, the proposition that all men are created equal means then that men must consent to government in order to be obligated by it. But it also implies that the government is, in some sense, based upon the enlightenment of those who consent to it. Take the simplest proposition imaginable, that those who must consent to government must do so in the light of the proposition that their consent is required. In other words, the proposition that all men are created equal does obviously cannot, in fact, apply to people who think that they are as inferior to other men or as superior to other men as dogs are in their relationship to men. Jefferson, in one of the last letters he wrote before his death, a letter that he wrote, in fact, on the approach of the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, which anniversary, by the way, did come finally to fall on the day that he died, as it was also the day that John Adams died. Jefferson wrote that the doctrine of the rights of man is now spreading across the world, and men no longer believe or are less inclined to believe that some men are born with saddles on their back and others booted and spurred to ride them. Because the idea which was characteristic of almost, and in fact I would say was characteristic of every society prior to the founding of the United States. Every political community prior to the United States was founded in some manner or other upon some version of the myth which we find expressed in Plato's Republic, namely that there are natural differences among men of such a character that they differ among themselves as much as men differ from animals of another species, that there is either gold, silver, or brass mixed in their souls, and that it is unnatural for the gold to be ruled by the silver, for the silver to be ruled by the brass. Some such myth, and certainly the medieval polity was based upon some such myth. Some such myth, and the doctrine of the divine right of kings was, of course, a late 16th, 17th century doctrine, which never had the historical importance that Jefferson attributed to it, but it was the doctrine against which the revolutionary thought of the American founding generation was directed. And the notion that some men were either chosen by God or had something in their natures which qualified them to rule other men, and that other men did not need to consent in order to confer legitimacy on government, this was the kind of doctrine against which the Declaration was directed. The Declaration was certainly, from this point of view, a very revolutionary doctrine, notwithstanding its essential continuity with the broad tradition of natural rights and natural law. That continuity, however, has this important hallmark, namely that the doctrine of natural right and natural law had never been an explicit part of the founding of any nation. In fact, it had not been part of the political teaching upon which any political community had been based. It had been a doctrine for philosophers before then, philosophers who talked to each other, and not political men who attempted to found political communities upon philosophic truth. The first attempt to found a great polity upon philosophic truth was the American attempt, and the great date in that founding was the 4th of July, 1776. Let me just read a few passages from the end of the Kendall Carey book, which will, I think, show you something of the flavor, at least, of the controversy in which I feel we are engaged. This is only the shortest way in which I can give you the what I think is the essential thesis of the book. This is Appendix 1, and the first sentence, I think, tells all as to far as their position is concerned. We are far from believing that the equality clause of the Declaration is meaningless. What does it mean? Our best guess is that the clause simply asserts the proposition that all peoples who identify themselves as one, that is, those who identify themselves as a society, nation, or state for action and history, are equal to others who have likewise identified themselves. Put in another way, the Declaration asserts that Americans are equal to, say, the British and French. If the British and French can claim equality among the sovereign states of the world, so too can Americans. By an amazing coincidence, this is the exact argument that Stephen A. Douglas made in 1857 and in 1858 in his debates with Lincoln. And as a matter of fact, he was himself paraphrasing Taney. And Lincoln's answer to that was, well, he said, if we are just if the Americans are just equal to the British or to some other nation, that means we're equal to them in their unequal condition. The idea that the Americans only meant to emulate the European countries would mean to imply that they didn't mean to set up a political community that was fundamentally different in its principles, and the consciousness of the fundamental uniqueness of the American polity is certainly one of the predominant aspects of the of America's self-consciousness during its great revolutionary era. Another point that is made by Kendall and Carey, which is made quite frequently in the literature, is that we don't find any statement of about equality comparable to the great proposition of the Declaration in the Constitution. Nor does the Declaration of Independence itself contain any any bills of rights or any notion of a bill of rights in the sense of a statement, a philosophic statement of fundamental rights, as distinct from mere legal guarantees. Now, the explanation of that is a very simple one, and yet it has been overlooked by almost all recent scholars in the field, and that is that from the perspective of 1776 and 1787, the place for fundamental statements of rights was not in the federal constitution, but in the state constitutions, because they were the level at which people were conceived to organize themselves for political action. That was the primary level for organization. And then they, of course, put themselves together into a larger union. But in fact, I think every state constitution of the period does have the kind of fundamental statement which Kendall and Carey and others like them find is omitted from the federal constitution. But the framers of the federal constitution didn't see any necessity for repeating what was already had been stated by the people who in their own local communities had authorized them to draft the federal constitution. Let me just give you an example from two of the statements. But perhaps the best example is from the Massachusetts Bill of Rights of 1780, which was drafted by John Adams, and which was the preamble to the Massachusetts Constitution of that time. This is from the second paragraph of the preamble. The body politic is formed by a voluntary association of individuals. It is a social compact by which the whole people covenants with each citizen and each citizen with the whole people that all shall be governed by certain laws for the common good. So, in other words, society, political society, is conceived of as stemming from the voluntary action of individuals, that society itself is formed by the action of individuals who, when they have formed themselves into society by this social compact, then construct government which will implement their fundamental rights. And Article 1 of the Declaration says, all men are born free and equal and have certain natural, essential, and unalienable rights, among which may be reckoned the right of enjoying and defending their lives and liberties, that of acquiring, possessing, and protecting property. In fine, that of seeking and obtaining their safety and happiness. So when you see that all men are born equal, that means, of course, equality and freedom are reciprocal aspects of the same thing. That is to say, if no man is yet my ruler, in the sense that there's no man whom I see who can give me commands which I am obligated to obey, then I am, in that sense, free of any obligation to any living creature. And as such, I am free and equal. Freedom and equality are not, at their fundamental, theoretical, conceptual level, antithetical concepts. On the contrary, they are reciprocal aspects of the same thing. Now, Kendall and Carey try throughout their book to deny that the thought of the founders is fundamentally Lockean in character. But I don't see how one can read the preamble and first part of the Massachusetts Bill of Rights of 1780 without seeing that this is fundamentally Lockean in its formulation. The first proposition in the Virginia Bill of Rights, which Kendall and Carey also comment on at some length, is that all men are by nature equally free and independent and have certain inherent rights of which, when they enter a state of society, they cannot by any compact deprive or divest their posterity. Now, that means that all governments are set up to and can only be conceived of rationally to be consented to, so long as they are rationally conceived of as having the effect of securing these fundamental rights. Constitutional government in the American tradition can only be understood in the light of what reasonable men could conceive of as implementing those rights which they have by nature. The rule of law, for example, the rule that a man cannot be judge in his own cause, the rule that powers of government should be separated so that the executive which prosecutes should never have the power of judging, the separation, nor that the legislature should have the power of either executing or judging the laws. These are inferences understood from the primary purpose of government, conceived of as emanating from the rights which men have, which are antecedent to all society, and which they can consent to as rational beings. That means, of course, that when people become irrational in what they consent to, when people conceive of their security as being better affected by a totalitarian government which is based upon plebiscitary democracy, we can say that the people have gone out of their minds. Because the very idea of a constitution is understood as a set as of a primary inferences from the understanding of equality as a state or character that men have in virtue of the order of creation in which there are beings certainly lower and perhaps higher, but in which the subordination of the higher to the lower is conceived of as essential perversion, and in which the just subordination of the lower to the higher is considered normal and natural. It is because of that idea of such an order that I believe that the American political tradition, I believe that it consists essentially in that view of equality and that view of inherent and natural rights, which reasonable men can understand and which does control the fundamental structure of government. Now, just one further point, and that is, in what sense is equality an end of government? Well, I think that it is an end in the sense that that any man who reasonably consents to be ruled in a way which is in his interest. And certainly, consent cannot be given to suicidal impulses, nor can it be given to measures which destroy the symmetry of the government and make it the representative of a part of the community as opposed to the whole, or in which the structure of government provided by constitutions is fundamentally upset, either by the aggregation of property, let us say, in such unequal amounts as to destroy the symmetry of the Constitution, or by the violation of private property in such a way that the government becomes the possessor or the regulator of all property and the rights of individuals to acquire property and to pursue happiness through the possession of their own property is fundamentally endangered. I see no possible connection between egalitarianism, as it is understood widely today by conservatives and liberals alike, and the proposition of equality contained in the Declaration of Independence and reaffirmed so magisterially and I think so wisely by Lincoln at Gettysburg. Thank you very much.